on your way to big bucks. Don't screw it up. Just work hard, play the game, buy new cars, build bigger homes, the works. Just like all the other guys. Don't try to be no hero. I don't want to use the pictures. Okay, okay. Chapter 21. For 17 days and 17 nights, the troubled lives of Mitch and Abby McDear proceeded quietly, without interference from Wayne Terrence or any of his confederates. The routines returned. Mitch worked 18 hours a day, every day of the week, and never left the office for any reason except to drive home. Lunch was at the desk. Avery sent other associates to run errands or file motions or appear in court. Mitch seldom left his office, the 15-by-15 sanctuary where he was certain Terrence could not get him. If possible, he stayed out of the halls and men's rooms and coffee room. They were watching, he was sure. He was not sure who they were, but there was no doubt that a bunch of folks were vitally interested in his movements. So he stayed at his desk, with the door shut most of the time, working diligently, billing like crazy and trying to forget that the building had a fifth floor, and on the fifth floor was a nasty little bastard named Devasher, who had a collection of photographs that could ruin him. With each uneventful day, Mitch withdrew even more into his asylum and became even more hopeful that perhaps the last episode in the Korean shoe store had scared Terrence, or maybe gotten him fired. Maybe Voyles would just simply forget the entire operation, and Mitch could continue along his happy way of getting rich and making partner, and buying everything in sight. But he knew better. To Abby, the house was a prison, though she could come and go at will. She worked longer hours at school, spent more time walking the malls, and made at least one trip each day to the grocery store. She watched everyone, especially men in dark suits who looked at her. She wore black sunglasses so they could not see her eyes. She wore them when it was raining. Late at night, after supper alone, while she waited for him, she stared at the walls and resisted the temptation to investigate. The phones could be examined with a magnifying glass. The wires and mics could not be invisible, she told herself. More than once, she thought of finding a book on such devices so she could identify them. But Mitch said no. They were in the house, he assured her, and any attempt to find them could be disastrous. So she moved silently around her own house, feeling violated and knowing it could not last much longer. They both knew the importance of appearing normal, of sounding normal. They tried to engage in normal talk about how the day went, about the office and her students, about the weather, about this and that. But the conversations were flat, often forced and strained. When Mitch was in law school, the lovemaking had been frequent and rowdy. Now it was practically non-existent. Someone was listening. Midnight walks around the block became a habit. After a quick sandwich each night, they would deliver the rehearsed lines about needing exercise and head for the street. They held hands and walked in the cold, talking about the firm and the FBI and which way to turn. Always the same conclusion. There was no way out. None. 17 days and 17 nights. The 18th day brought a new twist. Mitch was exhausted by 9 p.m. and decided to go home. He had worked nonstop for 15.5 hours, at 200 per. As usual, he walked the halls of the second floor, then took the stairs to the third floor. He casually checked each office to see who was still working. No one on the third floor. He followed the stairs to the fourth floor and walked the wide rectangular hallway as if in search of something. All lights, except one, were off. Royce McKnight was working late. Mitch eased by his office without being seen. Avery's door was closed, and Mitch grabbed the doorknob. It was locked. He walked to the library down the hall, looking for a book he did not need. After 2 weeks of the casual late-night inspections, he had found no closed-circuit cameras above the halls or offices. They just listen, he decided. They do not see. He said goodbye to Dutch Hendricks at the front gate and drove home. Abby was not expecting him at such an early hour. He quietly unlocked the door from the carport and eased into the kitchen. He flipped on a light switch. She was in the bedroom. Between the kitchen and the den was a small foyer with a roll-top desk where Abby left each day's mail. He laid his briefcase softly on the desk, then saw it. A large brown envelope addressed with a black felt marker to Abby McDear. No return address. Scrawled in heavy black letters were the words, "Photographs, do not bend." His heart stopped first, then his breathing. He grabbed the envelope. It had been opened. A heavy layer of sweat broke across his forehead. His mouth was dry, and he could not swallow. His heart returned with the fury of a jackhammer. The breathing was heavy and painful. He was nauseous. Slowly, he backed away from the desk, holding the envelope. She's in the bed, he thought. Hurt, sick, devastated, and mad as hell. He wiped his forehead and tried to collect himself. Face it like a man, he said. She was in the bed, reading a book with the television on. The dog was in the backyard. Mitch opened the bedroom door and Abby bolted upright in horror. She almost screamed at the intruder until she recognized him. You scared me, Mitch. Her eyes glowed with fear, then fun. They had not been crying. They looked fine. Normal. No pain. No anger. He could not speak. Why are you home? She demanded, sitting up in bed, smiling now. Smiling? I live here, he said weakly. Why didn't you call? Do I have to call before I can come home? His breathing was now almost normal. She was fine. It would be nice. Come here and kiss me. He leaned across the bed and kissed her. He handed her the envelope. What's this? He asked nonchalantly. You tell me. It's addressed to me, but there was nothing inside. Not a thing. She closed her book and laid it on the night table. Not a thing. He smiled at her and kissed her again. Are you expecting photographs from anyone? He asked in complete ignorance. Not that I know of. Must be a mistake. He could almost hear DeVasher laughing at this very moment on the fifth floor. The fat bastard was standing up there somewhere in some dark room full of wires and machines, with a headset stretched around his massive bowling ball of a head, laughing uncontrollably. That's strange, Mitch said. Abby pulled on a pair of jeans and pointed to the backyard. Mitch nodded. The signal was simple, just a quick point or a nod of the head in the direction of the patio. Mitch laid the envelope on the roll-top desk and for a second touched the scrawled markings on it. Probably DeVasher's handwriting. He could almost hear him laughing. He could see his fat face and nasty smile. The photographs had probably been passed around during lunch in the partner's dining room. He could see Lambert and McKnight and even Avery gawking admiringly over coffee and dessert. They'd better enjoy the pictures, damn it. They'd better enjoy the remaining few months of their bright and rich and happy legal careers. Abby walked by, and he grabbed her hand. "What's for dinner?" he asked, for the benefit of those listening. "Why don't we go out? We should celebrate since you're home at a decent hour." They walked through the den. "Good idea," said Mitch. They eased through the rear door, across the patio, and into the darkness. "What is it?" Mitch asked. "You got a letter today from Doris. She said she's in Nashville, but will return to Memphis on the 27th of February. She says she needs to see you. It's important." It was a very short letter. "The 27th? That was yesterday." "I know. I presume she's already in town. I wonder what she wants."
"Yeah, and I wonder where she is."
"She said her husband had an engagement here in town."
"Good. She'll find us," Mitch said.
Nathan Locke closed his office door and pointed to Vasher in the direction of the small conference table near the window. The two men hated each other and made no attempt to be cordial. But business was business, and they took orders from the same man.
"Lazarov wanted me to talk to you alone," DeVasher said. "I've spent the past 2 days with him in Vegas, and he's very anxious."
"They're all anxious, Locke, and he trusts you more than anyone else around here. He likes you more than he likes me."
"That's understandable," Locke said with no smile. The ripples of black around his eyes narrowed and focused intensely on DeVasher.
"Anyway, there are a few things he wants us to discuss."
"I'm listening."
"McDear's lying. You know how Lazarov's always bragged about having a mole inside the FBI. Well, I've never believed him, and still don't, for the most part. But according to Lazarov, his little source is telling him that there was some kind of secret meeting involving McDear and some FBI heavyweights when your boy was in Washington back in January. We were there, and our men saw nothing, but it's impossible to track anyone 24 hours a day without getting caught. It's possible he could have slipped away for a little while without our knowledge."
"Do you believe it?"
"It's not important whether I believe it. Lazarov believes it, and that's all that matters. At any rate, he told me to make preliminary plans to, take care of him."
"Damn, DeVasher, we can't keep eliminating people."
"Just preliminary plans, nothing serious. I told Lazarov I thought it was much too early and that it would be a mistake. But they are very worried, Locke."
"This can't continue, DeVasher. I mean, damn! We have reputations to consider. We have a higher casualty rate than oil rigs. People will start talking. We're gonna reach a point where no law student in his right mind would take a job here."
"I don't think you need to worry about that. Lazarov has put a freeze on hiring. He told me to tell you that. He also wants to know how many associates are still in the dark."
5, I think. "Let's see. Lynch, Sorrell, Bunton, Myers, and McDear."
"Forget McDear. Lazarov is convinced he knows much more than we think. Are you certain the other 4 know nothing?"
Locke thought for a moment and mumbled under his breath.
"Well, we haven't told them. You guys are listening and watching. What do you hear?"
"Nothing from those 4. They sound ignorant and act as if they suspect nothing."
"Can you fire them?"
"Fire them?
They're lawyers, DeVasher. You don't fire lawyers. They're loyal members of the firm."
"The firm is changing, Locke.
Lazarov wants to fire the ones who don't know and stop hiring new ones. It's obvious the Phibbies have changed their strategy, and it's time for us to change as well. Lazarov wants to circle the wagons and plug the leaks. We can't sit back and wait for them to pick off our boys.
Fire them? Locke repeated in disbelief. This firm has never fired a lawyer.
Very touching, Locke. We've disposed of five, but never fired one. That's real good. You've got a month to do it, so start thinking of a reason. I suggest you fire all four at one time. Tell them you lost a big account and you're cutting back.
We have clients, not accounts.
Okay, fine. Your biggest client is telling you to fire Lynch, Sorrell, Bunton, and Myers. Now start making plans.
How do we fire those four without firing McDear?
You'll think of something, Nat. You got a month. Get rid of them and don't hire any new boys. Lazarov wants a tight little unit where everyone can be trusted. He's scared, Nat. Scared and mad. I don't have to tell you what could happen if one of your boys spilled his guts.
No, you don't have to tell me.
What does he plan to do with McNear? Right now, nothing but the same. We're listening 24 hours a day, and the kid has never mentioned a word to his wife or anyone else. Not a word. He's been corralled twice by Terrence, and he reported both incidents to you. I still think the second meeting was somewhat suspicious, so we're being very careful. Lazarov, on the other hand, insists there was a meeting in Washington. He's trying to confirm. He said his sources knew little, but they were digging. If, in fact, McDear met with the Phibbies up there and failed to report it, then I'm sure Lazarov will instruct me to move quickly. That's why he wants preliminary plans to take McDear out.
How do you plan to do it?
It's too early. I haven't given it much thought. You know he and his wife are going to the Caymans in 2 weeks for a vacation. They'll stay in one of our condos, the usual. We wouldn't do it there again. Too suspicious. Lazarov instructed me to get her pregnant.
McDear's wife?
Yep. He wants them to have a baby. A little leverage. She's on the pill, so we gotta break in, take her little box, match up the pills, and replace them with placebos. At this, the great black eyes saddened just a touch and looked through the window. What the hell's going on, Devasher? He asked softly. This place is about to change, Nat. It appears as though the feds are extremely interested, and they keep pecking away. One day, who knows, one of your boys may take the bait, and you'll all leave town in the middle of the night.
I don't believe that, Devasher.
A lawyer here would be a fool to risk his life and his family for a few promises from the feds. I just don't believe it will happen. These boys are too smart and they're making too much money. I hope you're right.
Chapter 22. The leasing agent leaned against the rear of the elevator and admired the black leather miniskirt from behind. He followed it down almost to the knees, where it ended, and the seams in the black silk stockings began and snaked downward to black heels. Kinky heels, with little red bows across the toes. He slowly worked his way back up the seams, past the leather, pausing to admire the roundness of her rear, then upward to the red cashmere sweater, which from his vantage point revealed little, but from the other side, was quite impressive, as he had noticed in the lobby.
The hair landed just below the shoulder blades and contrasted nicely with the red. He knew it was bleached, but add the bleach to the leather mini and the seams and the kinky heels and the tight sweater hugging those things around the front. Add all that together and he knew this was a woman he could have. He would like to have her in the building. She just wanted a small office. The rent was negotiable. The elevator stopped. The door opened and he followed her into the narrow hall. "This way," he pointed, flipping on a light switch. In the corner he moved in front of her and stuck a key in a badly aged wooden door. "It's just two rooms," he said, flipping on another switch. "About 200 square feet." She walked straight to the window. "The view's okay," Tammy said, staring into the distance. "Yes, a nice view. The carpet is new, painted last fall. Restrooms down the hall. It's a nice place. The entire building's been renovated within the past 8 years. He stared at the black seams as he spoke. "It's not bad," Tammy said, not in response to anything he had mentioned. She continued to stare out the window. "What's the name of this place?" "The Cotton Exchange Building, one of the oldest in Memphis. It's really a prestigious address." "How prestigious is the rent?" He cleared his throat and held a file before him. He did not look at the file. He was gaping at the heels now. "Well, it's such a small office. What did you say you needed it for?" "Secretarial work. Freelance secretarial." She moved to the other window, ignoring him. He followed every move. "I see. How long will you need it?"
"6 months, with an option for a year."
"Okay, for 6 months, we can lease it for $350 a month." She did not flinch or look from the window. She slid her right foot out of the shoe and rubbed the left calf with it. The seam continued, he observed, under the heel and along the bottom of the foot. The toenails were red. She cocked her rear to the left and leaned on the windowsill. His file was shaking. "I'll pay $250 a month," she said, with authority. He cleared his throat. There was no sense being greedy. The tiny rooms were dead space, useless to anyone else, and had not been occupied in years. The building could use a freelance secretary. Hell, he might even need a freelance secretary.
$300, but no less. This building is in demand. 90% occupied right now.
$300 a month, and that's too low. We're barely covering costs at that. She turned suddenly, and there they were, staring at him. The cashmere was stretched tightly around them.
"The ad said there were furnished offices available," she said.
"We can furnish this one," he said, eager to cooperate.
"What do you need?"
She looked around the office. "I would like a secretarial desk with credenza in here, several file cabinets. A couple of chairs for clients. Nothing fancy. The other room does not have to be furnished. I'll put a copier in there."
"No problem," he said with a smile.
"And I'll pay $300 a month, furnished."
"Good," he said as he opened a file and withdrew a blank lease. He laid it on a folding table and began writing. "Your name?"
"Doris Greenwood."
Her mother was Doris Greenwood. And she had been Tammy Inez Greenwood before she ran up on Buster Hemphill, who later became, legally, Elvis Aaron Hemphill, and life had pretty much been downhill since. Her mother lived in Effingham, Illinois.
"Okay, Doris," he said with an effort at suaveness, as if they were now on a first-name basis and growing closer by the moment. "Home address."
"Why do you need that?" she asked with irritation.
"Well, we just need that information."
It's none of your business.
Okay, okay. No problem. He dramatically scratched out that portion of the lease. He hovered above it. Let's see. We'll run it from today, March 2nd, for 6 months until September 2nd. Is that okay?
She nodded and lit a cigarette. He read the next paragraph.
Okay, we require a $300 deposit and the first month's rent in advance.
From a pocket in the tight black leather skirt, she produced a roll of cash. She counted 6 $100 bills and laid them on the table.
Receipt, please, she demanded.
Certainly, he continued writing.
What floor are we on? She asked, returning to the windows.
9th. There's a 10% late charge past the 15th of the month. We have the right to enter at any reasonable time to inspect. Premises cannot be used for any illegal purpose. You pay all utilities and insurance on contents. You get one parking space in the lot across the street, and here are 2 keys.
Any questions?
Yeah. What if I work odd hours? I mean, real late at night?
No big deal. You can come and go as you please. After dark, the security guard at the front street door will let you pass.
Tammy stuck the cigarette between her sticky lips and walked to the table. She glanced at the lease, hesitated, then signed the name of Doris Greenwood. They locked up, and he followed her carefully down the hall to the elevator. By noon the next day, the odd assortment of furniture had been delivered, and Doris Greenwood of Greenwood Services arranged the rented typewriter and the rented phone next to each other on the secretarial desk. Sitting and facing the typewriter, she could look slightly to her left out of the window and watch the traffic on Front Street. She filled the desk drawers with typing paper, notepads, pencils, odds and ends. She placed magazines on the filing cabinets and the small table between the 2 chairs where her clients would sit. There was a knock at the door.
"Who is it?" she asked.
"It's your copier," a voice answered. She unlocked the door and opened it. A short, hyperactive little guy named Gordy rushed in, looked around the room, and said rudely, "Okay, what do you want it?"
"In there," Tammy said, pointing to the 8x10 empty room with no door on the hinges.
2 young men in blue uniforms pushed and pulled the cart holding the copier. Gordy laid the paperwork on her desk.
"It's a mighty big copier for this place. We're talking 90 copies a minute with a collator and automatic feed. It's a big machine."
"Where do I sign?" she asked, ignoring the small talk. He pointed with the pen.
6 months at $240 a month. That includes service and maintenance and 500 sheets of paper for the first 2 months. You want legal or letter-sized?"
"Legal."
"First payment due on the 10th and same thereafter for 5 months. Operator's manual is on the rack. Call me if you have any questions."
The 2 servicemen gawked at the tight, stone-washed jeans and the red heels and slowly left the office. Gordy ripped off the yellow copy and handed it to her.
"Thanks for the business," he said.
She locked the door behind them. She walked to the window next to her desk and looked north, along Front. 2 blocks up on the opposite side, floors 4 and 5 of the Bendini building were visible. He kept to himself with his nose buried deep in the books and the piles of paperwork. He was too busy for any of them, except Lamar. He was very much aware that his withdrawal was not going unnoticed. So, he worked harder. Perhaps they would not be suspicious if he billed 20 hours a day. Perhaps money could insulate him. Nina left a box of cold pizza when she checked out after lunch. He ate it while he cleared his desk. He called Abby. Said he was going to see Ray and that he would return to Memphis late Sunday. He eased through the side door and into the parking lot. For 3.5 hours, he raced along Interstate 40 with his eyes on the rearview mirror. Nothing. He never saw them. They would probably just call ahead, he thought, and wait for him somewhere up there. In Nashville, he made a sudden exit into downtown. Using a map he had scribbled, he darted in and out of traffic, making U-turns wherever possible, and in general, driving like a nut. To the south of town, he turned quickly into a large apartment complex and cruised between the buildings. It was nice enough. The parking lots were clean and the faces were white. All of them. He parked next to the office and locked the BMW. The payphone by the covered pool worked. He called the cab and gave an address 2 blocks away. He ran between the buildings, down a side street, and arrived precisely with the cab. Greyhound bus station, he said to the driver. And in a hurry? I've got 10 minutes.
Relax, pal. It's only 6 blocks away.
Mitch ducked low in the rear seat and watched the traffic. The driver moved with a slow confidence and 7 minutes later stopped in front of the station. Mitch threw 2 fives over the seat and darted into the terminal. He bought a one-way ticket on the 4:30 bus to Atlanta. It was 4:31, according to the clock on the wall. The clerk pointed through the swinging doors. Bus number 454, she said, leaving in a moment. The driver slammed the baggage door, took his ticket, and followed Mitch onto the bus. The first 3 rows were filled with elderly blacks. 12 more passengers were scattered toward the rear. Mitch walked slowly down the aisle, gazing at each face and seeing no one. He took a window seat on the 4th row from the rear. He slipped on a pair of sunglasses and glanced behind him. No one. Damn it! Was it the wrong bus? He stared out the dark windows as the bus moved quickly into traffic. They would stop in Knoxville. Maybe his contact would be there. When they were on the interstate and the driver reached his cruising speed, a man in blue jeans and Madras shirt suddenly appeared and slid into the seat next to Mitch. It was Terrence. Mitch breathed easier. "Where have you been?" he asked. "In the restroom." "Did you lose them?" Terrence spoke in a low voice while surveying the backs of the heads of the passengers. No one was listening. No one could hear. "I never see them, Terrence, so I cannot say if I lost them. But I think they would have to be supermen to keep my trail this time." "Did you see our man in the terminal?" "Yes. By the payphone with a red Falcon's cap. Black dude." "That's him. He would have signaled if they were following." "He gave me the go-ahead." Terrence wore silver reflective sunglasses under a green Michigan State baseball cap. Mitch could smell the fresh, juicy fruit. "Sort of out of uniform, aren't you?" Mitch said with no smile. "Did Voiles give you permission to dress like that?" "I forgot to ask him. I'll mention it in the morning." "Sunday morning?" Mitch asked. "Of course. He'll want to know all about our little bus ride. I briefed him for an hour before I left town." "Well, first things first, what about my car?"
"We'll pick it up in a few minutes and babysit it for you. It'll be in Knoxville when you need it. Don't worry."
"You don't think they'll find us?"
"No way. No one followed you out of Memphis, and we detected nothing in Nashville. You're clean as a whistle."
"Pardon my concern. But after that fiasco in the shoe store, I know you boys are not above stupidity."
"It was a mistake, all right."
"A big mistake. One that could get me on the hit list."
"You covered it well. It won't happen again."
"Promise me, Terrence. Promise me no one will ever again approach me in public." Terrence looked down the aisle and nodded. "No. Terrence, I need to hear it from your mouth. Promise me."
"Okay, okay. It won't happen again, I promise."
"Thanks." Now maybe I can eat at a restaurant without fear of being grabbed. You've made your point.
An old black man with a cane inched toward them, smiled, and walked past. The restroom door slammed. The Greyhound rode the left lane and blew past the lawful drivers.
Terence flipped through a magazine. Mitch gazed into the countryside. The man with the cane finished his business and wobbled to his seat on the front row.
"So what brings you here?" Terence asked, flipping pages.
"I don't like airplanes. I always take the bus."
"I see. Where would you like to start?"
"Voyle said you had a game plan."
"I do. I just need a quarterback."
"Good ones are very expensive."
"We've got the money."
"It'll cost a hell of a lot more than you think.
The way I figure it, I'll be throwing away a 40-year legal career at, say, an average of $500,000 a year."
"That's $20 million bucks.
"I know, but we can negotiate."
"That's good to hear.
You're assuming that you'll work, or practice, as you say, for 40 years.
"That's a very precarious assumption.
Just for fun, let's assume that within 5 years we bust up the firm and indict you along with all of your buddies, and that we obtain convictions and you go off to prison for a few years. They won't keep you long because you're a white-collar type, and of course you've heard how nice the federal pens are. But at any rate, you'll lose your license, your house, your little BMW, probably your wife. When you get out, you can open up a private investigation service like your old friend Lomax. It's easy work, unless you sniff the wrong underwear."
"Like I said, it's negotiable."
"All right, let's negotiate. How much do you want?"
"For what?"
Terence closed the magazine, placed it under his seat, and opened a thick paperback. He pretended to read. Mitch spoke from the corner of his mouth with his eyes on the median.
"That's a very good question," Terence said softly, just above the distant grind of the diesel engine. "What do we want from you?"
"Good question.
First, you have to give up your career as a lawyer. You'll have to divulge secrets and records that belong to your clients. That, of course, is enough to get you disbarred, but that won't seem important. You and I must agree that you will hand us the firm on a silver platter. Once we agree, if we agree, the rest will fall in place. Second, and most important, you will give us enough documentation to indict every member of the firm and most of the top Meralto people. The records are in the little building there on Front Street."
"How do you know this?"
Terence smiled. "Because we spend billions of dollars fighting organized crime. Because we've tracked the Meraltos for 20 years. Because we have sources within the family. Because Hodge and Kaczynski were talking when they were murdered. Don't sell us short, Mitch."
"And you think I can get the information out?"
"Yes, counselor. You can build a case from the inside that will collapse the firm and break up one of the largest crime families in the country. You gotta lay out the firm for us. Whose office is where? Names of all secretaries, clerks, paralegals. Who works on what files? Who's got which clients? The chain of command. Who's on the fifth floor? What's up there? Where are the records kept? Is there a central storage area? How much is computerized? How much is on microfilm? And most important, you gotta bring the stuff out and hand it to us. Once we have probable cause, we can go in with a small army and get everything. But that's an awfully big step. We gotta have a very tight and solid case before we go crashing in with search warrants. Is that all you want?"
No. You'll have to testify against all your buddies at their trials. Could take years.
Mitch breathed deeply and closed his eyes. The bus slowed behind a caravan of mobile homes split in two. Dusk was approaching, and one at a time, the cars in the westbound lane brightened with headlights. Testifying at trial? This he had not thought of. With millions to spend for the best criminal lawyers, the trials could drag on forever. Terrence actually began reading the paperback, a Louis L'Amour. He adjusted the reading light above them as if he was indeed a real passenger on a real journey. After 30 miles of no talk, no negotiation, Mitch removed his sunglasses and looked at Terrence.
What happens to me?
You'll have a lot of money, for what that's worth. If you have any sense of morality, you can face yourself each day. You can live anywhere in the country with a new identity, of course. We'll find you a job. Fix your nose. Do anything you want, really.
Mitch tried to keep his eyes on the road, but it was impossible. He glared at Terrence.
Morality? Don't ever mention that word to me again, Terrence. I'm an innocent victim, and you know it.
Terrence grunted with a smart-ass grin. They rode in silence for a few miles.
What about my wife?
Yeah, you can keep her.
Very funny.
Sorry.
She'll get everything she wants.
How much does she know?
Everything.
He thought of the girl on the beach.
Well, almost everything.
We'll get her a fat government job with a Social Security Administration anywhere you want.
It won't be that bad, Mitch.
It'll be wonderful.
Until an unknown point in the future when one of your people opens his or her mouth and lets something slip to the wrong person, and you'll read about me or my wife in the paper. The mob never forgets, Terrence. They're worse than elephants, and they keep secrets better than your side. You guys have lost people, so don't deny it.
I won't deny it. And I'll admit to you that they can be ingenious when they decide to kill.
Thanks. So where do I go?
It's up to you. Right now we have about 2,000 witnesses living all over the country under new names with new homes and new jobs. The odds are overwhelmingly in your favor.
So I play the odds?
Yes. You either take the money and run or you play big shot lawyer and bet that we never infiltrate.
That's a hell of a choice, Terrence.
It is. I'm glad it's yours.
The female companion of the ancient black man with the cane rose feebly from her seat and began shuffling toward them. She grabbed each aisle seat as she progressed. Terrence leaned toward Mitch as she passed. He would not dare speak with this stranger in the vicinity. She was at least 90, half-crippled, probably illiterate, and could care less if Terrence received his next breath of air. But Terrence was instantly mute. 15 minutes later, the restroom door opened and released the sounds of the toilet gurgling downward into the pit of the Greyhound. She shuffled to the front and took her seat.
"Who is Jack Aldrich?" Mitch asked.
He suspected a cover-up with this one, and he carefully watched the reaction from the corner of his eye. Terrence looked up from the book and stared at the seat in front of him.
"Name's familiar.
I can't place him."
Mitch returned his gaze to the window.
Terrence knew. He had flinched, and his eyes had narrowed too quickly before he answered. Mitch watched the westbound traffic.
"So who is he?" Terrence finally asked.
"You don't know him?"
"If I knew him, I wouldn't ask who he was." He's a member of our firm. You should have known that, Terrence. The city's full of lawyers. I guess you know them all. I know the ones at Bendini, Lambert, and Locke. The quiet little firm you guys have been studying for 7 years. Aldrich is a 6-year man who allegedly was approached by the FBI a couple of months ago. True or false? Absolutely false. Who told you this? It doesn't matter. Just a rumor around the office. It's a lie. We've talked to no one but you since August. You have my word. And we have no plans to talk to anyone else, unless, of course, you decline, and we must find another prospect. You've never talked to Aldrich. That's what I said. Mitch nodded and picked up a magazine. They wrote in silence for 30 minutes. Terrence gave up on his novel and finally said, "Look, Mitch, we'll be in Knoxville in an hour or so. We need to strike a deal if we're going to. Director Voiles will have 1,000 questions in the morning." "How much money?" $500,000. Any lawyer worth his salt knew the first offer had to be rejected. Always. He had seen Avery's mouth drop open in shock and his head shake wildly in absolute disgust and disbelief with first offers, regardless of how reasonable. There would be counter-offers and counter-counter-offers and further negotiations, but always the first offer was rejected. So by shaking his head and smiling at the window as if this was what he expected, Mitch said no to $500,000. "Did I say something funny?" Terrence, the non-lawyer, the non-negotiator, asked. "That's ridiculous, Terrence. You can't expect me to walk away from a gold mine for $500,000. After taxes, I net $300,000 at best. And if we close the gold mine and send all you Gucci-footed hotshots to jail? If you knew so much, why haven't you done something? Voiles said you boys have been watching and waiting for 7 years. That's real good, Terrence. Do you always move so fast? Do you want to take that chance, McDear? Let's say it takes us another 5 years, okay? After 5 years, we bust the joint and send your ass to jail. At that point, it won't make any difference how long it took us, will it? The result will be the same, Mitch." "I'm sorry. I thought we were negotiating, not threatening. I've made you an offer." "Your offer is too low. You expect me to make a case that will hand you hundreds of indictments against a group of the sleaziest criminals in America. A case that could easily cost me my life. And you offer a pittance. $3 million at least." Terrence did not flinch or frown. He received the counteroffer with a good, straight poker face, and Mitch, the negotiator, knew it was not out of the ballpark. "That's a lot of money," Terrence said, almost to himself. "I don't think we've ever paid that much." "But you can, can't you?" "I doubt it. I'll have to talk to the director." "The director? I thought you had complete authority on this case. Are we going to run back and forth to the director until we have a deal?" "What else do you want?" "I've got a few things in mind, but we won't discuss them until the money gets right." The old man with the cane apparently had weak kidneys. He stood again and began the awkward wobble to the rear of the bus. Terrence again started his book. Mitch flipped through an old copy of Field and Stream. The Greyhound left the interstate in Knoxville 8:02. Terrence leaned closer and whispered, "Take the front door out of the terminal. You'll see a young man wearing an orange University of Tennessee sweatsuit standing beside a white Bronco. He'll recognize you and call you Jeffrey. shake hands like lost friends, and get in the Bronco. He'll take you to your car.
Where is it? Mitch whispered.
Behind the dorm on campus.
Have they checked it for bugs?
I think so. Ask the man in the Bronco. If they were tracking you when you left Memphis, they might be suspicious by now. You should drive to Cookeville. It's about 100 miles this side of Nashville. There's a Holiday Inn there. Spend the night and go see your brother tomorrow. We'll be watching also, and if things look fishy, I'll find you Monday morning.
When's the next bus ride?
Your wife's birthday is Tuesday. Make reservations for 8 at Grisanti's, that Italian place on Airways. At precisely 9, go to the cigarette machine in the bar, insert 6 quarters, and buy a pack of anything. In the tray where the cigarettes are released, you will find a cassette tape. Buy yourself one of those small tape players that joggers wear with earphones and listen to the tape in your car. Not at home, and sure as hell not at the office. Use the earphones. Let your wife listen to it. I'll be on the cassette, and I'll give you our top dollar. I'll also explain a few things. After you've listened to it a few times, dispose of it.
This is rather elaborate, isn't it?
Yes, but we don't need to speak to each other for a couple of weeks. They're watching and listening, Mitch. And they're very good. Don't forget that.
Don't worry.
What was your football jersey number in high school?
14.
And college?
14.
Okay. Your code number is 1414. Thursday night, from a touch-tone payphone, call 757-6000. You'll get a voice that will lead you through a little routine involving your code number. Once you're cleared, you will hear my recorded voice, and I will ask you a series of questions. We'll go from there.
Why can't I just practice law?
The bus pulled into the terminal and stopped. I'm going on to Atlanta, Terrence said. I will not see you for a couple of weeks. If there's an emergency, call one of the 2 numbers I gave you before.
Mitch stood in the aisle and looked down at the agent.
$3 million, Terrence. Not a penny less. If you guys can spend billions fighting organized crime, surely you can find $3 million for me.
And Terrence, I have a third option. I can disappear in the middle of the night, vanish into the air.
If that happens, you and the Moraltos can fight each other till hell freezes over, and I'll be playing dominoes in the Caribbean.
Sure, Mitch. You might play a game or two, but they'd find you within a week, and we wouldn't be there to protect you.
So long, buddy.
Mitch jumped from the bus and darted through the terminal.
Chapter 23. At 8:30 a.m. on Tuesday, Nina formed neat piles out of the rubble and debris on his desk. She enjoyed this early morning ritual of straightening the desk and planning his day. The appointment book lay unobstructed on a corner of his desk. She read from it.
You have a very busy day today, Mr. McDear.
Mitch flipped through a file and tried to ignore her.
Every day is busy.
You have a meeting at 10 o'clock in Mr. Mahon's office on the Delta shipping appeal.
I can't wait, Mitch mumbled.
You have a meeting at 11:30 in Mr. Tolar's office on the Greenbrier dissolution, and his secretary informed me it would last at least 2 hours.
Why 2 hours?
I'm not paid to ask those questions, Mr. McDear. If I do, I might get fired. At 3:30, Victor Milligan wants to meet with you.
About what?
Again, Mr. McDear, I'm not supposed to ask questions. And you're due in Frank Mulholland's office downtown in 15 minutes.
Yes, I know. Where is it?
The Cotton Exchange building. 4 or 5 blocks up front at Union. You've walked by it 100 times.
Fine, what else?
Shall I bring you something back from lunch?
No, I'll grab a sandwich downtown.
Wonderful. Do you have everything for Mulholland?
He pointed to the heavy black briefcase and said nothing. She left, and seconds later Mitch walked down the hall, down the stairs, and out the front door. He paused for a second under a street light, then turned and walked quickly toward downtown. The black briefcase was in his right hand. The burgundy eel-skin attaché was in his left. The signal. In front of a green building with boarded windows, he stopped next to a fire hydrant. He waited a second, then crossed Front Street. Another signal. On the ninth floor of the Cotton Exchange building, Tammy Greenwood of Greenwood Services backed away from the window and put on her coat. She locked the door behind her and pushed the elevator button. She waited. She was about to encounter a man who could easily get her killed. Mitch entered the lobby and went straight to the elevators. He noticed no one in particular. A half-dozen businessmen were in the process of talking as they came and went. A woman was whispering into a payphone. A security guard loitered near the Union Avenue entrance. He pushed the elevator button and waited, alone. As the door opened, a young, clean-cut Merrill Lynch type in a black suit and sparkling wingtips stepped into the elevator. Mitch had hoped for a solitary ride upward. Mulholland's office was on the seventh floor. Mitch pushed the 7 button and ignored the kid in the black suit. As the elevator moved, both men dutifully stared at the blinking numbers above the door. Mitch eased to the rear of the small elevator and set the heavy briefcase on the floor, next to his right foot. The door opened on the fourth floor, and Tammy walked nervously in. The kid glanced at her. Her attire was remarkably conservative. A simple, short-knit dress with no plunging necklines, no kinky shoes. Her hair was tinted to a soft shade of red. He glanced again and pushed the closed door button. Tammy brought aboard a large black briefcase, identical to Mitch's. She ignored his eyes, stood next to him, quietly setting it next to his. On the 7th floor, Mitch grabbed her briefcase and left the elevator. On the 8th floor, the cute young man in the black suit made his departure, and on the 9th floor, Tammy picked up the heavy black briefcase full of files from Bendini, Lambert, and Locke, and took it to her office. She locked and bolted the door, quickly removed her coat, and went to the small room where the copier was waiting and running. There were 7 files, each at least an inch thick. She laid them neatly on the folding table next to the copier and took the one marked Coker Hanks to East Texas Pipe. She unhooked the aluminum clasp, removed the contents from the file, and carefully placed the stack of documents and letters and notes into the automatic feed. She pushed the print button and watched as the machine made 2 perfect copies of everything. 30 minutes later, the 7 files were returned to the briefcase. The new files, 14 of them, were locked away in a fireproof file cabinet hidden in a small closet, which was also locked. Tammy placed the briefcase near the door and waited. Frank Mulholland was a partner in a 10-man firm that specialized in banking and securities. His client was an old man who had founded and built a chain of do-it-yourself hardware stores, and at one point had been worth $18 million before his son and a renegade board of directors took control and forced him into retirement. The old man sued. The company countersued. Everybody sued everybody, and the suits and countersuits had been hopelessly deadlocked for 18 months. Now that the lawyers were fat and happy, it was time to talk settlement. Bendini, Lambert, and Locke handled the tax advice for the son and the new board, and 2 months earlier Avery had introduced Mitch to the hostilities. The plan was to offer the old man a $5 million package of common stock, convertible warrants, and a few bonds. Mulholland was not impressed with the plan.
His client was not greedy, he explained repeatedly, and he knew he would never regain control of the company. His company, remember. But $5 million was not enough. Any jury of any degree of intelligence would be sympathetic to the old man, and a fool could see the lawsuit was worth at least, well, at least $20 million.